Hello, and welcome to the first ever podcast for Cartsaluni, the online literary magazine. This is for our Mammoth Water issue, which was announced on May 1st, began publication on May 14th, and ran through July 10th. My name's Dave Bonta. I'm one of the two managing editors of Cartsaluni, along with Beth Adams, who will join us later on to read some of the selections. The format for this podcast will consist of recordings read by the authors whenever possible, with Beth and me filling in where needed. We got the idea too late to involve the issue editors, Catherine Durham, Old Mixon, and Lucy Kempton, but let me begin by at least reading their summary of the issue from the Notes and Contributors post that capped it off. They write, "We were wedded by the voices and the visions, touched by water in contact with so many others as we spent these days and nights listening and reflecting. Reflecting, what impresses is the swell of diverse and multiple perspectives, emerging, prominent, echoing. It's no accident that we both traveled the seas during this time, swimming in immediate experience and the mediated perceptions of others. That we are on other sides of our watery planet also brought dimension to our selections. Selections, it finally came down to what we hadn't or already scooped, netted, drank, bathed, or slept through. We found ourselves often gurgling, gasping, like thirsty street bathers at a fire hydrant. We would surface stunned, say yes, no. Of course, an acceptance or a refusal had as much to do with where we were in a drink as how sweet the spring. And the springs have been sweet and various. Baths, baptisms, swims, rain, fog, ice and snow, deaths and births, mythical and natural water creatures, historical and personal encounters with the element, lakes, rivers, streams, seas, tubs, pools, spigots, puddles, or the absence of water, droughts as well as floods, and from all over our blue-green earth, including Asia, Africa, Europe, and the Americas. We are replenished, and hope you are too. Out over aquamarine, like pelicans, our bills filled with good things. We begin with Volume, read by the author, Lena Heckman Ayers.
Volume. This is a poem of water. You cannot hold it in your thoughts without it taking the shape of what you already had in mind.
Born in the year of deluge, Eve Rivka. Born in the year of deluge, hope slips away like eels beyond grasp and spear. All learn to hold ear inside, nurturing internal voices. Meditate on escaping breath. Born in the year of deluge, seas of expectation wash away. Nothing is stable. Seaweed and broken shells tangle and punctuate sorrows for the forgotten. Beginning in deluge, there is always too much, and the scent of mildew carries death. Mold greens underarms, and all crevices fester and rot. Born in a year of deluge, one always seeks shelter, umbrellas, overhanging eaves, the comforting arms of mermaids with scaly tails, dreams of love in salty places."
That was Eve Rivka reading her piece, Born in the Year of Deluge. Next, we're going to have a reading by Beth Adams of Jessamine Smythe's piece called Bathe.
Bathe. Wine dark steam embrace, flicker light. Incense rises, I submerge, rise. Waves of my own hair blind, myrrh-soaked, a rosemary tress blindfold. Water takes pain from muscle bruised black. Blood rises, condenses, trickles to nothing. A foot on the overflow to keep abundance in, add heat to already pinkening warmth. I think about names and soup, intimate histories and magical principles, comfort freely given, received. Chicken rubbed with ginger, garlic, pepper, lemon after lemon, the whole juice beaten into eggs until the broth is Mediterranean sun, the taste a cure for everything. I think about shapes words make, landscapes of cresting dolphins, oceans of lions, Nemean and otherwise, swimming the sky. Hunger grows quietly.
Next, we have Christina Pacos reading her piece, White Heron Waiting.
White Heron Waiting, by the willow where fish freeze in the dark shadow of cascading green. Be still, cry the gills. The heron tilts its head, watching for a ripple, some sign, a reward for careful scrutiny. This bird is an anomaly on the Ivy River, too far north and more familiar with sea marsh or estuary. An albino great blue, perhaps, but exotic in any case. Here where the river twines through old rock, this day when the radio hawks war, war, the heron pauses on yellow legs and eyes the shallows for the sustenance it knows is there.
Following the ghostly image of a whale, we had a piece entitled What We Ate After Passing the Cape of 11,000 Virgins, and this will be read by the author, Luisa A. Igloria.
What We Ate After Passing the Cape of 11,000 Virgins. My lord, it was the feast of St. Ursula. Thus was Fernando moved to name the cape we rounded after passing the Straits of Tierra del Fuego. There were, of course, no such creatures to be seen, only the sea, always the sea, its tangles of kelp matted like hair, wanting the ministrations of a tortoise shell comb. It is many, many months since our last memory of women, candled fingertips touched to holy water in the basin, pale ankles glimpsed as they ascended dark stairways leading to rooms suffused with a mingled scent of rancid sausages and violets. The hardships we have endured, 3 months and 20 days since we laid bare the last of our provisions. All that remains we eat, old biscuits ground to powder, sifted with grubs and sawdust. We soaked strips of oxhide from the main yard in seawater, then roasted them on coals. This is how we entered the Cape of Desire, retching and heaving. And those calm waters which Fernando christened Pacific, the horizon a line, clean as a hem of bleached muslin, rippling in the wind.
Next up, Alan Peterson reads his poem, Waterspout.
Waterspout. Waterspout, a tooth out of heaven, bites down slowly, hollow like a viper's. You can see it sending displeasure through. The water is disturbed and sends up vapor like smoke from a drill bit. If it bites deep, it may spin fishes till scales fly off from their bodies. You can hear it rushing through downpour, with a sound like vacuuming and small coins falling.
Next, here's Fiona Robin reading Aldbur Beach.
Aldbur Beach. This morning, the waves are restless. Underneath them, things are living out their lives. Pebbles are piled up at the sea edge as if trickled from a huge hand. Each one has its own genealogy, a parent rock, a place it has travelled from. The fine rain is almost horizontal. I breathe it in, dissolve it into my blood. The sea is happiest as froth, stretching out its fingers, skipping faster, making shapes. When it bangs itself onto the shore, it feels a release, as if moving its shoulder blades diagonally, one way and then the other.
Next, we have a piece called Lost at Sea, read here by the author, Nancy Gandhi.
Lost at sea. The sea wrenched him open, entered him, until he was separate no longer, sent him on the current road to the far meeting of air and water. As he dissolved into the great ocean, his limbs twined with those of other creatures to form compound monsters, combing the deeps with cloudy fingers. I heard the waves whisper, but their message was unclear. Myriad voices murmured stories, washed white as bone. I tried to hold him with dream-slow hands, but the tide pulled him onward, adrift, shifting, shape-changing, lost to me.
Next, we have Diane Gage reading Fish Face.
Fish Face. Deep in sea rye live murmurs, tales drifting to shore, about fish that can talk, promise-making fishes, wish-granting fishes, even fish with human faces. One such fish fetched up in a net off the west coast one day and spooked the crew, who calmed themselves by teasing the youngest among them. "Look, kid, here's your granny, or is it your girlfriend?" The boy blushed, shoveled his feet, looked out over the ocean. The fish, who couldn't talk, lay dying on the deck. His life flashed through his memory, a saga of absurd yearning, a life spent swimming from sea to sea, looking for faces just like these.
Susan V. Fechnitz is up next with a bit of sound art she recorded for her poem Flotsam.
Flotsam. I knew the salt of water. The sea uncivilizes us, rages in the blood, suss and slap against the hull. Don't simmer this down. Don't set the waves straight. But up on deck, or ringed along shoreline, faces bare themselves to spray for that sense of the saline, porous stalks of sea life brushing the land. Once in the water, we touch bony bottom, our breath globes above us.
Next up, Lisa J. Kylar reads Far From Any Ocean.
Far From Any Ocean. Come with me and I will make you fishers of men. Something I would want to be. Collect people and hang them from a stringer from the back of my boat. I used to stand in a lake up north, with my lover hugged up behind, teaching me to cast a fly. Thick yellow line sings through the air, light tippet touches down. Below the surface, walleye, trout, bass, large and smallmouth, look up through the waters. I collect green bottle glass from along shores of Great Lakes to look back at them.
David Graham is next with Ashes to Ashes, Water Over All.
Ashes to Ashes, Water Over All. Pasigo Lake, August 2007. Accompanied only by my dog, I bury Dad's ashes in the rock garden. Mom asked for no fuss, no ceremony at all, but I invent my own. Rinsing this jar, his ashes came in with Pasigo Lake water, then pouring it slowly over the ash and dirt and mint, green still and displaced earth. A small shower that says, water we are and water we shall be. Dad, who rode into and out of the mist every morning on this long-loved lake, might as well rest here as in any supernal cloud, or marked by any chiseled stone. Who was water then, and is water now? Blood, sperm, tears, the sweat of fever, all salted with what we might as well call love, and so I do.
Next, here's Pia Tavila with Waste.
Waste. A solitary figure walks the bridge span as water rushes through drain pipes below. The rank smell of earth and runoff rises to the pavement. Streetlights splay on pitted asphalt, potholes, the roadway ruined by the snowplow's blade. It's a woman rummaging through her pocketbook. She opens a handkerchief, drops something shiny into the river, its round weight falling through mist-filled air. At the last second, she sees a gold glint as it disappears, black eddies swirling, closing over its hollow core.
Ellen Goldstein is next, reading The Rainwalkers.
The Rainwalkers. Mark us, the ones who sit at bus stops and let the buses go by. The ones who leave warm rooms to walk through a thousand tiny ribs of water, who pass each other with a nod. Send us past banks of yellow windows, flickering TVs, couples on couches, roommates laughing under strings of lights. Drench us with need. Let life well up from our footsteps until the streets run with it.
Okay, now let's slow the pace down a little. I'm going to read a story by Janet Young that appeared next in the issue. Watering Hole. Edwin straddled the ladder, clutching the hose with his free hand. Cleaning out the gutters had never been his favorite job, but he'd promised Margaret he would get it done before the next storm. It always seemed to rain a lot in May, he mused. Thinking about other things was the only way to take his mind off what he considered his imminent doom, losing his balance and crashing to the ground. Maybe it was part of Margaret's plan to get him out of the picture. Ever since he retired, she seemed to be finding more ways of putting him in peril. The house was a single story, but the fall might be bad enough to break something. Anything higher than one story, he would have refused. He'd heard about a man falling to his death while painting second-story windows. "You don't have to be that high up," he groused, pushing wet leaves with the hose. "Maybe we should move," he suggested, when Margaret spotted the rain spilling over the gutters and hinted they might be full of leaves and debris. "Don't be ridiculous. You simply need to clean out the gutters." "Don't we have someone to do that?" he moaned. The expression on Margaret's face at the remark made him wish he'd been a little more enthusiastic. "We do, but I don't think we should wait. Look at the sky. It's going to start coming down again, and the next thing you know, the basement will flood." Flood was an exaggeration. Margaret knew exactly what would happen. Water would pour in under the basement door and the east wall. Then a couple days later, it would be fine. Water intrusions had been a constant problem with the place, the basement taking in substantial amounts of it their first spring in the brick ranch. That year, torrents of rain followed quickly on the heels of melting snow, saturating the ground. "What are we supposed to do?" Margaret asked, surveying the mess, and Edwin shrugged. Margaret was under the misconception his gender automatically endowed him with practical skills. "Let it dry out and hope it doesn't happen again," was his response. Hoping it didn't happen again became a catchphrase in their lives, and Edwin developed the remarkable talent of tuning Margaret out when she was in the mood for an actual solution. "All right," he said, slipping into his jacket, preparing for the task after he determined it was pointless to try and talk her out of it. "Do you want me to hold the ladder?" Margaret offered as he fumbled with his zipper. "No, I'll be fine." Then she disappeared into the kitchen to set about one of the many household duties that managed to consume a big part of her day. Margaret never seemed to run out of things to do, a puzzlement to Edwin. Outside there was a chill in the air, and he was glad he'd worn the jacket. He dragged the ladder from the garage and started at the rear of the house. It was the easiest, the ladder on the level concrete patio. "This won't take long." He began to whistle, and Margaret waved at him as she stood by the kitchen sink. He moved to the side once he'd finished out back, thinking about going over to the neighborhood spot for a beer. He frequented the place afternoons when Margaret didn't have any chores for him or was spending the day with her sister or friends. Margaret didn't seem to mind. He'd sit on a bar stool and chat with Jack, the bartender, who said Edwin was lucky to be retired. "I'd love to be in your shoes," Jack said, and Edwin would nod. Edwin mostly was at the bar to socialize and could make one beer last all afternoon. He'd usually leave a larger tip since he hadn't spent much drinking. Lately, Edwin had begun to strike up conversations with a couple other old-timers who happened to be in the same boat. "I never thought I'd be like that," Edwin said, squirting more water at a tenacious clump of twigs and leaves stuck in the corner. Almost finished, he decided whatever they paid the gutter guy, it wasn't enough. The latter shuddered with every move. He should get off the ladder and move it closer so he could grab the mess, but he didn't want to climb down it one more time only to climb back up. Besides, he wanted to get to the neighborhood spot before the evening rush and before Margaret found another job for him. He tossed the hose to the ground, counting himself lucky the nozzle didn't crash against a window as it bounced away from him, and then stretched his right arm as far as he could, grasping the gutter with his left hand. Suddenly the ladder shifted from under him, and he found himself slipping downward. "Crap," he said as he fell, flailing his arms, trying to grip something to break his fall. He landed with a thud next to a shrub in need of trimming, and sat for a moment, surveying the damage. The side of the gutter was bent, the leaves and twigs clinging to the edge. "More than I can say for me." He stood slowly, slightly shaky, and checked himself for any obvious injuries. He'd be bruised in the morning. Peeking through the window, Edwin spotted Margaret stretched out on the sofa, her eyes closed, oblivious to his brush with death. He pushed the ladder towards the foundation. He could put it away later, time now to slip away while he was in one piece. Today he might indulge in more than one beer. He certainly deserved it. Tom Sheehan is up next with Korean Echo.
Korean Echo. My turn had come. Billy Pig, helmet blown lost, shrapnel more alive in him than blood free as air, dying in my arms. Billy asked a blessing, none come his way since birth. My canteen came his font. Then he said, I never loved anybody. Can I love you? My father told me his turn long gone downhill. Keep water near you. Always. He thought I'd be a priest before all this was over. Not a lover.
Next up, an essay by Nathalie Boissard-Béodin, Water That Was.
Water That Was. Listen to its song haunting your dreams. Water. Water flowing, soothing your tired muscles, cooling your raw stained with sweat and sand. Fresh and clean tasting. Not like the tepid brew you have in your flask, laced with chemicals to ensure no harm will come to you. Already on day one of that desert trek, you started to fantasize about clean, cool water. A shower, a drink, a pool. And now, well into day nine, memory of the clear fluid haunts your burning and thickened bloodstream like a sluggish nightmare. Water. Never again will you waste it. Every time its sweet taste flows into your mouth, you will feel life and peace flow through your veins. As when you were a student and meals were few and far between, every morsel was a feast. Have you forgotten the taste of freshly baked bread? The aroma that did away with far more than hunger, frustration and stress were soothed away with just a few bites. Bread. Life. Water. No soda, no wine, no alcohol would ever satisfy you more right now. Mint tea is fine. Mint tea is great, in fact. It does away with the most urgent thirst, and its sugar will keep you from just collapsing after the day's trek. But water. You are tracing its path on the stones along the road, trying to decipher the message its souls have left on the surface to tease you. Ghosts of water that was. Worse than a mirage, because you know that this is not an illusion. Water was here. Here where you stand now. Here where you need it now. Where it isn't anymore.
Penny Harder is next with her piece entitled Camping in the Drought.
Camping in the Drought. That summer at the turkey farm, the Maine woods tinder dry, dust kicked up around our tent in the unrelenting heat. Each morning we walked down to the lake, following the daily retreat of water from the shore of Builder's Sand, the wet pulling back like lips from gums, gums from teeth. And we walked into it further and further those 10 long days, feet fighting slimy weeds, torso sinking in a lake so shallow with its own decay, our bodies stank. That summer at the turkey farm, we did not touch each other because of the heat, the dust, the turkeys thirsty gobbling through the dark.
Celia Lissay Alvarez is next, reading about restrictions.
Restrictions. The lawn is lemon yellow, a knee of the house. Not scraped, but sunburnt, tight. No words can recall its Florida winter, those choices between cold and wet. I don't care if I get fined, my mother says, and puts her finger to the mouth of the hose to fan the hot water over her collection of spider plants. At night I can hear the crickets watching me, posed weightless on the leaves. They do not breathe, nor do I, nor do we sleep. The backyard holds its breath, silent, not hot, but dark. The brass rim of the hose burns my thigh, leaves a pink welt, like a kiss. I want to hold it over my head and let it flow down my neck, down my shirt, but I am afraid. I feel the hose stiffen. With just one squeeze from my hand, it would burst. The umbrella tree loses its leaves first. The yard is littered with its beached canoes. Then the palms. My mother pulls the oranged fronds from the crowded trunk, her brown shoulders growing large and square. I don't know how much longer I can take this, she says, drinking from the hose, which she's left running all morning, the water pooling around her ankles.
Next up is Rainy Season by Juliet Wilson, read here by Beth.
Rainy Season, Malawi, 1991. Strange how the water so often failed in the rains. We rushed out in swimsuits to shower in the deluge, laughing as we shared soap and shampoo, our simmering enmity almost forgotten. Water flowed in rivulets down our breasts and thighs. The warm scent of rain-drenched soil. The fish eagle's cry.
Marion McCready is next with Looking Beyond.
Looking Beyond. A rook flies over sandbanks, over us parked by a sea of gorse. Across the holy loch, a church is wedged between trees. The hills behind are a downy haze of birch, the mountains glazed with snow. The sky drips with clouds blown beyond the reach of wingtips. We drive deep into the neck of hills. Ripples travel fast across the loch, faster than the cormorant swooping past the crannog. Lost in the slopes and trees, lost in the saltless loch, you turn to me, and for a moment, as in the puddle beneath the gorse, I see an image of me in the water blossom of your eyes.
Nicholas Y.B. Wong is next with Transformer, read here by a friend of his, Roger Fang.
Transformer. I used to think you're solid, as I'm. Like petals that speak to the colorblind, or the ice refusing to melt under the fatherly sun. But I see you can be the mucus on a toad, or the flakes on a skating ground, to be incised by silvery blades. You give the Octobering touch, or you're the touch in October. I see your desire evaporate. Passing, falling petals on a running river, which delivers lovers. Solid is about solidarity. This is the first time I learned from water. Feel sorry for ice.
Walking on Water is the title of the next piece, read here by the author Paul Dickey.
Walking on Water. Ripples slosh over your ankles trying to wash you up. Say what can't be done. Those who love you do not want you to take such risks. They are wrong. There is no reason the color of water cannot be the same as a skyway. Do not be distracted if your image drops below the surface. It is not you, it is a shadow. Forget all the sounds that have brought you here and now. Leave. You have given up everything. The ground under your feet, it is not to be found now beneath this body of water. Each day imagine yourself new. Take one step before another. Expect dust to accumulate underfoot again. Slowly, let whatever wants to be green grow beneath you. Sometime in your life, you may begin to walk with a pause, but there is no reason to fall until you come to the end of your river.
Scott Wiggerman is the next author, reading Baptism.
Baptism. A young man stares into the sun, seizes air through his mouth like one who's been underwater too long. lungs filling with the deep scents of mud and summer grasses. He steps out of his sandals, strips off his shirt and shorts, and slips into the shallow creek, hips wedged on the rocky bottom, body prone as a makeshift raft. Cold water bristles over and under his limbs. His pale torso bobs like a thin pink float. The eyes of the world retreat as hate sloughs away like dead skin. All that is left is blue sky, warm sun, cool water, and a rhythmic trickle that matches beat for beat the drumming of a buoyant heart.
Next up, Beth reads a piece by Robert McGowan called Ascent.
Ascent. Along the edge of our pond is a small platform that extends out over water. At its base is attached a floodlight mere inches above water level so that at night a beam directed to the opposite shore grazes the pond's surface. Light shines across still water that was warmed by daytime's hot sun, but that now, in darkness, is blanketed by cool and heavy night air. A silent white mist, diaphanous and phantom-like, slides over the glassy plain. The ghostly vapor careens across slick liquid, for a time in one direction, then in another, in response to causes I can neither see nor feel. It swirls and spikes and gathers itself into chimerical amorphous plumes, and it rises, disappearing into empty darkness above. Our pond ascends to sky.
Next up, W. Joe Hopp, Crawdad Creek. This is me reading, but I'm channeling a ghost in the machine.
Crawdad Creek is full of empty mojo candles, seven African towers, St. Jude, patron of lost causes, supplications for trabajo. We throw rocks towards the good side of good luck, sink pebbles inside the hollow of dinero. Not trying to break anything, really, just how stone and glass and creek bed, eyeball, hand grip, arm arc, the very air co-ordains.
Everywhere you look is luck. That's the title of the next piece, read here by the author, Rebecca Ellis.
Everywhere you look is luck. Between us, the night pulls back, deeply black and empty of argument. Seeds at our feet, the fine silt of abraded roads, millennia, and a sunrise, palest yellow. On the blunt edge, the well, the wide reservoir, cornflower blue, a late rescue. We're what has been hauled up.
Christy Krug is next, reading an essay called Water Rights. For those of you not following along with the text, that's R-I-T-E-S.
Water Rights. In the house of my aunt and uncle, each room had its own rules about what not to touch, how not to run, where not to eat. Pillars heralded the porch and cherrywood gleamed in the entry, naked of school papers, apple cores, cereal bowls. One night, after a visit from the police, I was taken from my mother and placed here among shining guest soaps and French provincial mirrors and real table dinners. If I had known more about fairy tales and remembered less about mother's screams, I would have pretended I was in a fairy tale. A day after my arrival, my cousin bent down and swept the long, sticky bangs from my eyes and proposed something I wasn't sure I could handle. "Come on," she said. "Let's give you a bath." Dirty toenails poked from my saltwater sandals as I stood motionless. Even though Cecilia was very old, 13, I didn't trust anybody to start my bath. Bathrooms were not happy places. Cecilia tapped the blonde banister with shellacked fingernails. I didn't understand how a person's nails could be ghost white like that. "It'll be okay," she said. I followed her upstairs where she opened a cupboard. It was a library of towels, each volume folded, tucked, and shelved. At home, our towels flop like dead rags, old curtains. In heaps, we pick off Mommy's bed. "And we'll wash your hair," it starts, standing on the cold bathroom floor. There is a sea green ring round the middle of the sink. I hugged tight my towel. Cecilia opened the door to one of the bathrooms I'd never seen, and I walked into a strange dawn. Where sunny yellow towels matched rug, matched yellow silk flowers in a straw vase, the toilet lid was covered with yellow shag, round as a cookie, softer than any chair at home. Old home. My home again sometime, maybe. I couldn't know. I was a netted fish, a trapped selkie. Cecilia turned on the bathtub water and plunged in her hand. Mommy puts a metal pan under the sink. Water whooshes. Mommy's hands shake, and I look up to the whiteness of the skin under her widow's peak, quiet with unhappy secrets, smooth and blue underneath, holding her voices and all the bad things to worry about in the world. Water gushed onto Cecilia's freckles, leapt from smooth porcelain, echoing past canyons of clean silver faucets. She paddled the wet into sudsy billows. "Get in." I threw my clothes down and inched my scaled tail over the bathtub edge. She pours onto my head. "Yow, hot," fills it up at the sink, pours, "ouch, cold, the waters never match." "Go on." I went into the steam, sank into the clear, ruffled at the edges with lace, underwear lace that hides your underparts but is never clean unless Mommy has time. Cecilia uncapped herbal essence with its smell of scissor-sharp flowers. "Mommy says, I'm sorry," and turns around and around to find a clean towel, and my hair is stringy seaweed in my face, and I have to cry. We slip and trip on the wet floor. Cecilia's freckled, other family hands reached for me. She swirled my head with shampoo. Her arms smelled like Love's baby soft perfume. "You don't have to sit so stiff. Here's how you rinse, see? Lie down and swish your hair. It's in Mommy's magazines. If you don't get all the suds." I sat up. "Your scalp will dry and crack, and you might get a rash or have to call someone, the doctor or the police or a neighbor you hardly know, and say, 'Something is wrong with me. I'm hearing voices. I need help right away.' All the suds won't come out that way," I cried. "Most will." Cecilia smiled. I scooted beneath the water, froth hissing in my ears. I closed my eyes against the clinging. The warmth was kind. It was enough, swishing like a mermaid freed from the deep down sea. And just as everybody kept saying things were going to be okay, maybe they would be.
Liskin Van Pelt Duss is next, with her piece, Self-Portrait as Aquifer.
Self-Portrait as Aquifer. As if flesh were permeable. Not flesh exactly, but the whole body we carry around, what we feel with, like rock, rain, sodden, permeable, channeler, willing, unwilling, of water's need to be going somewhere, like me right now, wanting to go out in the rain. How could I have known how deep you would enter me?
A Brief Meditation on Movement. That's the title of the next piece by Tim Lockridge, read here by Beth.
A Brief Meditation on Movement. I fell from the cliffs to the sea of arms, to the foam of hands, to the spaces of cities like cities could ever do something, could ever be more than a story or store where we waited through winter for a certain street vendor and stood at the edges of statues and sculptures and pointed at water, the shape of water in the place of a place we once took a taxi through, patterns of people, through movements of bodies, the firework nights like a furnace above us, the clang and rattle of hours like a river, the hem of a river that remembers the swish of the cliffs, of the hands, the falling, the feeling of falling, of finding there's nothing but nothing beneath.
Beth also reads the next poem, August Garden, by Robin Davidson.
August Garden. In the August garden in moonlight, the iron bells rust. The wind itself is rust and silence. What's left of water in the birdbath becomes the stone which holds it. The frog, the lilies, all pale green stone, green veins on white caladiums narrow toward stems drooping, leaning toward the clay. If I were a child, I would read or kneel, wait out emptiness till I could feel a rising in my chest like laughter or blood or song. But here on the stone steps, I ride the rhythm of loss. It loosens my hair at the roots, robs it of color strand by strand. It pulses blue in the raised veins in my hands, breasts, in the spreading veins behind my knees, dirty blue marble visible only when I stop, turn to look back. A wise man loves water. I long to believe contentment moves like a river within us, exceeding time and desire. August caladiums shine like white stones, heart-shaped, blank, but for vascular traces of green. I long to believe these are the traces of rapture not yet forgotten, bits of green nourishing the form they inscribe, sustaining them just above the soil so that it appears they wait a while, live as long as they can.
Crankbait was the next poem in the issue by Brent Goodman. And Brent couldn't make a recording for us this time, so I've done one myself here, and I've taken the liberty of reading it as quickly as possible because I really enjoyed the sound of the poem read at that speed. Crankbait. Louisiana drop shot slipknot crawler. Grandfather's dirt-bloodied, rock-rough hands. I bird-nest every other cast in the tea-dark water, while back to my back he tackles larger plans. Tri-hook torpedo lures, deep-diving silver spoons, giant-skirted spinner baits that churn and spit across sunrise mirror stillwater, past raucous loon. Even a scaled-down, taped-up Louisville slugger fit to pummel any lunker in the cross-eyed submission. By midday, we hardly speak. I bobber for pumpkin seed while he bullseyes musky patrolling the sunken reeds. Terrified yet of tooth and hook, grandeur or ambition, what difference between what I want and what I wish? Stop casting for minnows, son. Big lures, big fish. Kelly Madigan Erlandson is up next, reading Deep Subject.
Deep Subject. The boy has learned to fish without catching, an evolution from catch and release. The technique involves reeling the lure back to himself furiously after the cast, faster than the fish can swim. He explains that this way he can see them jump and chase, but doesn't have to face the daunting task of releasing them from the barbed hook. While he casts and reels, I tell my brother-in-law about my extra well. I am still new to this property. I know where my new well is, out behind the house, with its clean white stem protruding from the ground. But there is another well, west of the garage, covered with planks. A month ago, a friend and I pried a board up, and with the aid of a flashlight, peered into the circular brick structure reaching down into the dark. The flashlight beam reflected back up to us from the water's surface. My brother-in-law was raised here, born into a family that has owned the land nearby for over a century. He tells me this was the old well, probably hand-dug during the early part of the 20th century and abandoned when it ran dry or went bad. It poses a problem. Under normal circumstances, fertilizer, herbicides, and pesticides would be filtered by 20 to 50 to 70 feet of soil before joining forces with the groundwater. But an open chute offers a straight shot. Old wells should be capped. Peering down from the top, we can't see how deep this tunnel reaches. The water's surface, maybe 15 feet below us, reflects the surrounding brick walls. At his suggestion, we get a chain from an old porch swing and tie it to a brick. I hold the light while he lowers the brick hand over hand down the well shaft and into the water. He reaches the end of the chain and the brick has not reached the bottom. We add on a rope and then a second rope before it does. His son comes up from the pond as we put the board back in place. We know what it would mean to fall into a well in this remote valley, where one cannot be seen from the road, a road on which few vehicles travel anyway. Even if you could swim, there would be no place to swim to, with the surface of the water several body lengths below the rim. We warn the boy away from the danger. My husband says his father told him men in the bottom of wells could see stars in the daytime. My brother-in-law has heard this too, that the walls of the well block out sunlight sufficiently to make stars visible. It's a story with a long reach, recorded by Aristotle. Later, I tell him and his son a poem called In the Well about a boy being lowered down to the water to retrieve a dead dog. It's dark now, and the whippoorwills are calling. The boy and his dad head back over the hill for home. My nephew's desire is to fish but do no harm, and I am not sure I can bring myself to seal this circle of stone. Maybe after it has been drained, when I can climb down into it, I'll see something from the bottom that wasn't visible in the brightness of daylight.
Michael Milligan had the next piece in the issue called Swimming Lesson. This is me reading again. Swimming Lesson. The pond stretches into a great lake. The safe area marked by bright red floats strung on yellow rope. He wades until the water reaches his waist, stretches as the teacher instructs, arms straight past his head, straight back, face in the water. Here his skin, from head to toe, meets the world, and there is water at the surface. Water beneath the surface, water underwater, going on forever. He could sink all the way to China, not have to dig after all. If he drowns, he rises back to the light. Everyone applauds his dead man's float. Beth is up again for our next selection, Sipo Lake by Diane Kendig.
Sipo Lake. No larger than a tiddlywink, it would leave only a mist, land empty in a small cup. Still, it claims our attention. One winter, a neighbor boy drowned under the shrunken, flat, white disk. Often summers when nightfall renders the sky all colors, mirrors two worlds from one, sun running over. I can still hear his mother say she lives by that light.
Now it's back to me again for the next reading. This is Rain Dancers by Gil McEvoy. Rain Dancers. Nothing in the taps but a choke of air, cracks opening in our skin, the pond shrunk to a dull bullseye in a basin of mud, grass shriveled to bones and string. In the night, thrumming on slate, pooling in gaps, hissing in gutters, slapping on stones, whooshing down drains, at last it comes. As if a master switch were thrown, the lights go on, heads bob at panes like dark balloons, then people flood into the streets to splash and stamp and roll in wet. On the pavements, piles of night clothes rise like river banks. I'm also going to read the next poem, which is an untitled piece by Wanda McCollar. Water becomes the shape of its vessel, bold or curling round rocks. What scene softens as it slides down window panes? It fogs a field with beaded shawls, turning grass blades into bawdy surprises, bursts forth around a turn in the road as a lake, a vast plain sparkling, splashing over since childhood. Shuckswitch Road will be the next piece. This is by Pamela Johnson Parker. And this is read by Beth again. This will be the last before we return to a good long run of pieces read by the authors themselves.
Shuckswitch Road. The summer I turned 6, the Mississippi flooded our farm, following us to the second story. The third night, we got out by boat, oaring off in a slant of rain, leaving the car, the burly crop, the chickens, the family Bible, and the house like a girl waist high in water, white skirts wavering on its surface. The neighbors on King's Hill had coffee and quilts, holding them out like hands. Inside there was a fire, feather pillows. The cat had her kittens. Their mewling soprano sang me to sleep, and later, in fever, I dreamed the dream I still have when it rains, a country of sand, drought, camels, children, the tender swelling of their bones, small streams struggling into current.
Robbie Nestor is our next reader with her poem Picnic at the Big Lady, Quabbin Reservoir.
Picnic at the Big Lady, Quabbin Reservoir. The Quabbin rises as if bound to speak. The four lost towns, Dana, Enfield, Greenwich, and Prescott, murmuring of all that was before the emptied graves and cellar holes took on the impersonal and public face of history. Where now the bass patrol and deer nose out the fattest berries, old rumors and a persistent watching from behind. Were the windows open when water swept those barns and fields? Perhaps a table set for tea and cake spun slowly to the ceiling, flowers spilling from their vase, family photographs undeveloping to slicks of sepia within the darkening generic pool. I can still see the steeple dimpling the surface, whole towns caught like a breath beneath its phantom shadow, as in a small glass dome where no snow falls.
A brief change of season now to start off the second hour of the podcast. Here's Ed Higgins with Week's Rain.
Week's Rain. The seasonal stream dividing our near pasture from the back field, where I make my best late June hay, has swollen this January. Its white, slashing teeth threaten to take out the culvert bridge. Already, its rushing shoulders, massive as a running back's, erode the banks, undercut roots of wild cherry and plum, whip blackberry vines like witch's hair in the flow.
Lynn Shapiro is our next author, reading Replenish.
Replenish. A windless freeze sets the lake early this year. Black ice. Stare down hard into this watery clearing and see all the way to springtime. Leaves become trees that sway. Fish crouch in their bones awaiting the iridescent thaw. Pollen, roe, and eggs hatch into raucous food. I watch my husband and son skate in and out of another winter, their itineraries marked in scrapings, accompanied by croaking ice and the shadow of crows.
Now Liskin Van Pelt Dus returns to read her second poem in the issue, The Lake Isn't a Life.
The lake isn't a life, but it understands being forgotten, has learned to remember itself. Slow, heavy depths, the overflow of night, Earth's confidant. Not a color either, what we call blue, green, but a tone outside the spectrum. Liquefied light, sky poured into furrows, cold secret currents. It's stubborn, won't stop hammering the rocks, stirring the land. Mottled dream residue, the aftershock of rain, my breath made molten.
Next, we go Inside Leviathan, the title of a poem by Monica Raymond.
Inside Leviathan. But actually, I didn't take you far. Not far enough. I started to dream we were clothed, trying to make love. The time we crossed the bridge at night, the light's white moths to my myopic eyes, shimmering in aureoles of blurred flutter. I saw me push you off. I should have pushed you into something wetter, to that archaic world where knife-edge reds form, gleam, and tune the keyboards of apartments to cathedrals, where globes quicken to probes, poignards that seem to pierce the dark surface they ride on. That black horse latitude of luminescent jellyfish, where bitter sardine, small fry, those turned to dragons by the press of reflective scales, the dugong mermaids swim, all plankton inside Leviathan.
Charlotte Mandel is our next poet, reading The Mollusk World.
The Mollusk World, the Aquarium, Monterey, California.
At noon, the great hand breaches the world's rippling membrane, and a jet of pellets raises a swarm of yellow beefish. Coarser pellets meander, awaited by the O-mouthed, black-eyed rockfish, who waves transparent, ruffled fins, like a drag queen in summer georgette. Having wiggled its lump of backside into a hole in the reef, drilled by acid suction of a geoduck clam's feeding tube, a plasmatic, human-sized phallus. The clam, spent, revolving with tidal currents, will stumble across virgin coral. On the sandy bottom, striped angel wings refill muscular bellies, raking nutrients through toothed gums. All dross drifts to spiral-humped moon snails, who cleanse by grazing, devourer plows, patient in dim light. Where shadows of spectators swim the glass shield, in a dream of regaining so gentle a fit.
Next up, Intertidal, read by the author Angela France.
Intertidal. She tells me how it lives, quick and rich between tides, how its world shifts in swirls and sanded patterns on each waking, how it scurries to take all that's offered by each new land, exposed on the moon's whim, washed in the sea's run. How it waits out high tides in a bubble bound with silk. How each barnacle only has room for one.
Marley Yeomans is next, reading her piece, A May Flower.
A May Flower. Dorothy May Bradford drowned in Provincetown Harbor while the Mayflower was at mooring, December 7, 1620. In green-shot bays my sweetheart sleeps. She pierced the shadow of the boat and disappeared. Still I must keep my courage safe from fear she floats with staring eyes into the deeps where liquid devils jeer and gloat. Did sharp-fanged woods spur Dorothy to drink up death? No way to gloss over trials, nowhere to flee. Her heart could augur only loss. Whoever thought the changing sea would alter crossing into cross? We pilgrims in the wilderness must curb our fancy's imps and ghosts. A penitent, I here confess to glimpsing her along the coast. I meant to say, God's peace and rest, but words fall dead when wanted most.
Merman is next, by Gerard Wozzeck, or Wozzeck. Gerard, I'm sorry, and I apologize to everyone else in the course of this podcast whose name I have inadvertently murdered. A problem I didn't foresee when I got the idea of doing this project.
Merman. He loves the salt inside me. Cures my grieving with an unguent made from starfish limbs and foam. He trolls oceanic depths. Tide pools I cannot enter. His silhouette stains a scrim of clouds. I enter through his singing. Ancient chords, discordant tones. Myth still intact. I surrender. No one marks my vigils. Nights I give over to scrying over piers and jetties. I write my name on currents of ocean water and wait for my lover to surface.
Joe Hyam's poem Dry is up next. This is me reading. Dry. You know it best only when it's lost, in contraries, in opaqueness, in fire and dust, in the taste of salt on dry lips, and thirst crusting as you forage in fissure and cavern for its trace, remembering the fingers of the rain that stroked your head, and the thin paths of coolness they left, and the thoughts of mist and long grass. Deep, feigning dead, the seeds stand by. The lizard and the scorpion quiver in the heat, while in their blood the tall flood stacks up. Our next to last piece is by Alan Peterson, That Element.
That element, the one after earth, after air, after undercutting Colorado and making unapologetic ruins, after tugging on the moon, after fire, and remembering some of it disguised as winter in the fridge, shaggy and crystalline, stiff with fish. That one, what I was most of while alive.
Our final text for the issue was April Storm, a second contribution by Robin Davidson. This is me reading once again. April Storm. I lie in a bare mattress, watching blades of the ceiling fan slice lightning, batted in pieces from wall to wall, fireworks in the room's night sky. I am thinking of you and Habermas and of the logic of lightning, how reasonably nature behaves, catapulted from sky to earth to the rooms of human sleep, and how unreasonable I am, heart lens awake in the dark, filtering nature's design, to feel in the pulse of rain pelting the window your fingers of weeks, months ago, still tangled in my hair. Thanks for listening, and I'd be very interested in hearing any reactions that people might have. Obviously, I threw this together on quite short notice, with fairly primitive software, so if we're really going to make a going thing of it, I'll be looking for any kind of feedback that I can get. I also want to thank Lucy Kempton and Catherine Durham Old Mixon for their endless hours of hard work on this issue. They truly did an outstanding job, and they're the main reason for everything you heard here. Thanks to all the authors for sharing their work with us, as well as to the artists and photographers who let us print their work in the issue as well. And thanks to everyone for sitting in the darkness with us and waiting for something to burst.